As you know, the shuttle diplomacy which Dr. Kissinger attempted failed. Israel was prepared to withdraw from territory in the Sinai. Was prepared to withdraw from a few miles or to the top of the passes, or even to withdraw entirely behind the famous passes and from the area of the Abu Rodis oil fields. What Israel asked in return, negotiations are a matter of give and take. What Israel asked was some political considerations from Egypt, movement towards a state of non-belligerency. She would equate the degree of withdrawal by Israeli troops to the degree of political give evidenced by Egypt. How much Egypt was willing to do to move towards a condition of peace. And the failure of these negotiations is vivid testimony that though Israel was prepared to give many miles, Egypt was not prepared to give an inch. The Egyptians were not prepared to open their border to third country tourists. Egypt was not prepared to move away from active participation in the embargo against firms that do business with Egypt, with Israel. Egypt was not prepared to accept long-term demilitarization proposals for the Sinai, for the land from which the Israeli army would withdraw. Egypt was not prepared to agree to a long-term presence by the United Nations forces, peacekeeping forces, presence which would not be subject to United Nations actions for a number of years, actions which Israel has good reason to fear. Little or much, Egypt was not prepared to move from a state of belligerency, from a ceasefire towards peace. The Egyptian position, the very least, was that the pressure must be maintained against Israel, and that Israel had to give up these territories without any recompense, without anything being given by the Arab side. The model which the Egyptians had was obviously the model of the October negotiations, in which Israel had proved that she was willing to risk for peace, risk the removal of Israeli soldiers from the banks of the Suez Canal without a return in a political sense. There were no published provisions by Egypt which moved her from a state of active economic and political warfare against Israel and preparations for a military action against Israel towards a condition of non-belligerency. The most that Israel received during those October negotiations was the guarantee that there would be a United Nations presence in the Sinai between the two armies for a six-month period, and that the Egyptians would agree not to bring certain missiles and long-range cannon into the areas on the east bank of the Suez Canal. That was all. The Egyptian position was modeled after the success of their negotiations in October, the so-called first stage of the shuttle diplomacy, and by what had happened in 1956, when after the successful Israeli attack across the Sinai, when again her army stood at the banks of the Suez Canal, Secretary John Foster Dulles of the United States put pressure on Israel, embargoed Israel, forced Israel to withdraw from the Sinai entirely without any political give by Egypt of consequence, under the vague assurance and guarantee of the United States that cargo bound for Israel would be allowed to pass through the Suez Canal, that the Straits of Tiran would remain open so that oil and other shipping could move up the Gulf of Aqaba to Eilat, provisions which General Nasser was able to denounce freely when he found it expedient to do so, provisions which the United States did not in fact guarantee when it proved inauspicious to do so. Egypt has had reason in her recent history to know that Israel can be pressured by the United States. And she looked upon this second round of so-called negotiations as a continuation of what she had seen happen in 1956 and again in 1974. Now, one can accuse Anwar Sadat of inflexibility, obstinacy, but one cannot accuse him of inconsistency. He did not lie to Secretary Kissinger. He did not promise give to the secretary before he left to shuttle between the capitals of the Middle East. In fact, he signaled quite clearly to Washington and to the world that Egypt was not prepared at this time to enter into political negotiations with Israel, despite the fact that negotiations would have required a military give by Israel for a political give by Egypt, despite the fact that the two operative United Nations Security Council's decisions, that of November 1967, Resolution 242, and that of October of 1973, Resolution 338, required that the negotiations proceed along both lines, the political and the military, at the same time. In fact, he had signaled this to the world in a very important interview he had released through the correspondent of Le Monde, French newspaper, on the 22nd of January of this year, just 6 weeks before Dr. Kissinger arrived in Cairo. When asked by the columnist of Le Monde what Egypt was prepared to give by way of concessions to Israel in hopes of gaining back the Sinai, he answered bluntly, "We have nothing to give." And when asked when Egypt was prepared to enter into a truly peaceful relationship with Israel, would Egypt be willing to enter into a condition of non-belligerency once all of the Sinai was returned, the answer was again blunt. "We cannot enter into a condition of peace with Israel until all the territories which are Arab are returned and until the Palestinian problem is solved." The latter, of course, a loaded code word which can mean simply the rehabilitation and relocation of refugees, or can in fact mean the total dismemberment of the State of Israel into an Arab state. And so Anwar Sadat had spoken clearly. He had not equivocated. And Dr. Kissinger went to the Middle East regardless. And the very fact that Dr. Kissinger was willing to come to the Middle East was a clear indication to Cairo and to the other Arab capitals that he was prepared to exert pressure on Israel. Why else should he come? The Arabs had no reason to compromise. Things were going in their favor. Large amounts of oil capital were pouring into the oil-rich states, and some of that was being siphoned to the so-called confrontation states. Egypt in this spring was receiving arms from the Soviet Union, from almost every major country in Europe, and from the United States. She was receiving multi-million dollar loans from Japan, from West Europe, from the United States, from Russia. What need had she to compromise? No, the arrival of Dr. Kissinger was a clear signal to Cairo that he was prepared to pressure Israel to make compromises, not unlike those of October of 1974 and the spring of 1956, without a political return, without an end to the state of belligerency by the Arab countries, in this case by Egypt, because it was to the advantage of the United States to see that that happened. The United States does not want to go to Geneva. The United States of the last few years has moved towards a political posture in the Middle East, which is called even-handedness. If you look at it positively, it means that the United States wants to be friends with everyone. We want the oil, we want the markets, we want the construction contracts, we want all that the commercial opportunities of the Arab world. And because the Arab world is unstable, and because we have need, treaty need and otherwise, to protect Iran, we want the land base, which is Israel, to land our planes if need be. We want the highly effective and efficient army of Israel as a mobile striking force in order to prevent the corridor between the poor Arabs in the north and Iraq and Syria moving south against the feudal states of Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf, the oil-rich southern Arabs. It's Jordan and Israel which stand athwart that narrow coastal corridor down which the arms, the heavy arms, must come for the inevitable revolutions that must overthrow these highly feudal states. We want to see that this doesn't happen, at least as long as there is still oil in the ground that we want, and construction contracts which our business requires. We want to be friends with everyone. At least that's what we say even-handedness means. And if we are maneuvered to Geneva, where we and the Russians are the co-sponsors of a mandated negotiation procedure, where the third world will have a highly vocal presence, where all the Arab states will have a highly visible presence, where there'll be the demands for the Palestine Liberation Organization to be actually physically present in negotiation rooms, where, in fact, the United States will have to make decisions in favor of this country or against that country. We will have then to move to the practical consequences of a policy of even-handedness when those who we are trying to be friendly to are in fact enemies. We will have to make up our minds what we mean when we say we stand for the security of Israel within appropriate borders. And we will have to prove what we mean when we say we are concerned with the rights of all peoples of the area, and we are concerned with the economic development of the region. We will not be able to emerge, we being the United States, from Geneva with a policy of even-handedness. For we will offend some and probably offend all. And that's what Dr. Kissinger is trying very hard to avoid. It's for that reason that he's trying, given the obstinacy of the Arab world, to have Israel pay the price for America's ability to retain for the time being the stance of being the friend of all, the supporter of all legitimate interests and rights in the Middle East. If he could not bring a promise of non-belligerency to Egypt, what could he bring to Israel? What he could bring to Israel was a promise of more arms and some financial aid. And the question that Israel had to balance was exactly how much credence could be given to the promise of Dr. Kissinger. If Israel had agreed in March of 1975, the promise of Dr. Kissinger that he would send to Congress and Congress would pass a $2.5 billion foreign aid proposal on behalf of Israel, and that he would see to us, that he would see to Israel that the supersonic jets and the ground-to-ground missiles and other sophisticated weapons which they would like to add to their military inventory were made available under favorable terms. Was this worth the land, the withdrawal, the giving up of territory, which is all Israel will ever ultimately have to bargain when it comes to the final negotiations? How important was this arms plus these monies to Israel? How important was it to Israel to allow the United States to avoid choosing sides, making the hard decisions? More importantly, preceding all these decisions was the question, could in fact the professions and the promises of the American Secretary of State be trusted? Could the American Secretary of State guarantee to Israel that if in March of 1975 she withdrew beyond the Mitla and the Gidi passes and gave up the oil fields, that in December or October or November, late fall of 1975, the United States Congress would in fact pass a $2.5 billion foreign aid bill for Israel, given the mood of the United States, given the economic problems of the United States, given the pressures for more public welfare, more public assistance within the United States? And could, in fact, Israel trust in the guarantees that were being vaguely spoken about, that Israel would be supported in an hour of emergency by the arms or the active concern of the United States? It was obviously not to the United States' interest to suffer another oil embargo. But exactly what did America mean when she said that she was concerned with the sovereignty and the survival of Israel? Unfortunately, March of 1975 was not a good hour for the credibility of the United States. If Dun & Bradstreet rated the credibility of a nation's promise, our ratings would have suffered very badly. Just this week, and typical of any number of cartoons which have appeared in the Israeli press, the Jerusalem Post featured a cartoon of a man named Dosh, in which you see a seaside scene. There's a tower, a lifeguard. The lifeguard is Uncle Sam. And out there in the water, there are two swimmers drowning. One swimmer is called Saigon, and the other swimmer is called Nam Pen. And below the tower, there's a little Israeli boy with a Sabra hat on. And Uncle Sam, the lifeguard, is saying to the little boy, "Why are you afraid to go in the water? I'm here to protect you." That's the mood around the world, and particularly in Israel, where the margin of survival is so very thin. What good are the verbal guarantees of the United States? How much credence can be given to them? Certainly, no Secretary of State can any longer make important secret commitments which a country such as ours will live up to. And what are the open commitments? About 3 years ago, men in Washington, particularly those who were unfriendly to Israel in the circle of Senator Fulbright, began to speak of the United States signing with Israel a public guarantee of Israel's borders, and that in return for this guarantee, Israel should withdraw to the borders of 1949. Sounds very, very comforting when you're an American citizen, guarded by the might of the United States, trusting in your own government, to feel that now the United States government will enter into a public commitment to defend the borders of Israel. But then you look at the source, Senator William Fulbright, and you begin to wonder what this group really has in mind. And as you begin to examine the problem of guarantees, you recognize that it's a field which is mined with all kinds of trick and explosive devices. When are the borders of Israel threatened? What threatens them? A direct attack. What if those who attack make the claim that Israel attacked first, as the Arabs have in every one of the four Arab wars which have preceded the present situation? When must America respond? The day of the attack? After a presidential commission has made a long investigation of whether or not the attack was initiated by Israel or by the Arab world? If, as in 1967, the Arabs are on the move and Israel wants the 5 minutes advantage of preemption, does that void the whole guarantee? The talk of guarantee guarantees very little. It's a way of papering over the desire of the United States to gain a few years for its policy of being friends to everyone, of not having to make decisions between anyone. Rabin and his government heard. They were not particularly impressed. Much as they know how beholden they are for weapons and for support to the United States, given what was being offered, nothing of any real consequence. They could not, in good conscience, being leaders of a people whose very survival is threatened, have agreed to the proposals brought by Secretary Kissinger. And the very fact that the Secretary was interposing himself the needs of the American government between the Arabs and Jerusalem, they tried to indicate to Dr. Kissinger, in fact, was giving the Arabs the feeling that what they could not achieve by their own arms and by their own pressures, the United States would achieve for them, was in fact making them more obstinate and demanding than they might otherwise have been. So the negotiations failed. Israel proved ungrateful. Dr. Kissinger came back to the United States, and here he has initiated a policy which is one of petulance, of pressure, and of promise, in about equal measures. Publicly, he has been very circumspect, spoken about the difficulties of either side accepting the proposals which were made. Not a single negative word has been spoken about the Egyptian government and its inflexibility. But privately, he has let out his anger about what he calls Israeli inflexibility, and he has put words in the mouth of his president, who often speaks as if he were Dr. Kissinger's puppet in the area of foreign affairs. And he has made President Ford say quite openly that he wished that the Israelis had been more flexible. So Israel has been pictured, at least to those who listen to this administration, as obstinate. Sadat retains his peace-loving role, and we move on. The petulance has been there. And then the pressure. Almost immediately upon his return, the Secretary announced that there would be a major reassessment of our Middle Eastern policies. Our ambassadors from all the confrontation capitals were called back home. A very highly publicized meeting of American notables was held, the notables all of whom had a history of being relatively unfriendly to Israel, ranging from Dean Rusk to David Rockefeller. Subtly, and not so subtly, other governments were told by our State Department that we would welcome these governments using whatever influence they had with Jerusalem to make Israel agree to one or another of the policies which the United States was then trying to foist. The United States is still trying desperately to avoid going to Geneva. Israel has very little to lose by going to Geneva. She can always say no. She can always pack up and go home. The United States has a great deal to lose by going to Geneva. Because whereas the Russians will be 101% in favor of whatever the Arabs ask, and the Arabs will ask for everything and then some, the United States will try to play a role for a variety of reasons, some domestic, some international, to seem even-handed and balanced, and she can only offend it from that position. And the domestic pressures which exist on this government are not simply that of the Jewish vote. In fact, there's very little to do with the Jewish vote, Jewish power. It has to do with the power of big business, the power of the big banks, the power of all of those who see the possibility of great profits out there. It's very interesting to see business doing business with these Arab leaders in the same way they were so eager to do business with Germany in the 1930s. Big business conscience is often, unfortunately, in the sense of the ultimate decisions, the conscience of profits. And the profit motive can be one utterly insensitive to human need and to the concerns with freedom and democracy and other things that we talk about. We have seen the banks of Europe being willing to enter into consortiums which deliberately leave out Jewish banks. I assure you that any number of the biggest corporations in the United States have signed embargo agreements with the Arab countries. Recently, one of the companies in Cleveland which did not agree to sign such a paper, turned one over to us. It's fascinating. It's sent not by a military supplier, but by a hospital. A hospital and rehabilitation center in Cairo, which wants to build a very, very large new complex. And it was sent to any number of institutions around the country which have experience in building and architecture on a very, very large scale. The proposal, which asks whether or not this company is interested in submitting a bid, asks nothing about its assets, about its technical skills, about the time span in which it'd be able to operate. It says, has three operative paragraphs. By the act of submitting a proposal, the proposer declares he does not possess any plant, firm, or branch in Israel. He does not participate in any firm or company established in Israel. And he has not any supply, manufacturing, assembling, license, or technical assistance agreement with any firm, company, or person established or resident in Israel. The proposal further undertakes not to have, either by himself or through an intermediary, any such activity in Israel, and not to contribute in any way to the consolidation of the economy or the military efforts of Israel. It's as plain as you can be. And I assure you that there are very few companies which have acted as this one did in refusing to submit a bid. This comes from Egypt, the so-called peace-loving center of the Arab world, the one country with whom presumably Israel can fairly easily enter into agreements. The one country whose president, Sadat, has spoken openly of peace with Israel. One of the special assistants to Anwar Sadat was sent a year and a half ago to Washington as the new Egyptian ambassador to the United States. His name is Asraf Gorbal. Dr. Gorbal is an intimate of Mr. Sadat, specifically chosen for this important function. He made the mistake, I think, early this year of going down to the Argentine, a country which, as you know, has a very large number of ex-Germans, ex-Nazis living there, where there's a very strong, powerful, and public anti-Semitic movement. And he was at one particular meeting when I think he thought he was speaking in camera, just to the people who were there, and when he let himself speak openly about his concerns. And this, his remarks were translated into, by a paper called Machar, in Buenos Aires, and let me read you one or two of the quotes of this man who is the personal envoy of the peace-loving Dr. Sadat to our United States. For us, he said, Argentina is a sister country to which we feel united by identical ideals of liberation and aspirations of grandeur. Our understanding of the problems that confront you and the similarity of the objectives that mobilize both of us has deeply penetrated the conscience of all the Arab peoples. We are waiting the critical battle while we are embroiled in the struggle for victory. Our improved understanding has led to the complete identity of our causes and of our hopes of carrying on to the final victory. In this process for popular self-determination, which is not new, your Minister of Social Justice, Mr. José López, who is an extraordinary revolutionist, has played and still plays a fundamental role. Arafat and Gaddafi, those two patriots, given in body and soul to the cause of the Arab people and to the destruction of Israel, love him as a brother, and the material help that we give him will never be sufficient. The Arab peoples are convinced that the extermination of Judaism in the Middle East is the point of departure for any process of their liberation. Not only the extermination of Israel, but the extermination of Judaism. What in today's world is called the oil problem, that is the problem of the prices we demand in order to maintain our industries, is nothing more than a tactical procedure in the war against Judaism, in order to show them that the positions have been reversed, that they are now the dependents. Don't make mistakes. The psychological war being developed by certain big powers generalizes the unity of the West against our right to demand a just price for our fundamental product, oil. But the unity doesn't exist. What really exists is the objective of continuously using Judaism as a bridgehead in order to confront our independence and grandeur, which are not different from yours. Thus, our irrevocable decision is to destroy Judaism, as has been promised to you by our friends here in the United States, Russia, and also in your country, as has been established in the Argentine by Dr. Lopez. That's also part of the equation. Egypt has problems, domestic and international. Perhaps Egypt wants some measure of accommodation with Israel. But the passions are there. The active economic warfare is there. The history of being unwilling ever in the last 27 years to enter into the simplest of negotiations with Israel. What does Israel ask? Territory? Economic preference? No. Simply peace. And what are the Arab states, and in this case Egypt, unwilling to give? Peace. The Middle East is where it has always been, at stage one. The Arabs determined not to permit the long-term existence of the Jewish state in that part of the world. And until that emotional roadblock is opened, Israel will have to say to the United States, as he said in March of this year, we cannot solve your own economic problems. We cannot give up our ability to survive because you want to avoid making some hard decisions. And yes, we know that some of these decisions may go against us, and that our friends in the United States will be turbulent and angry and use whatever pressures they can. We're sorry. Well, what other alternative do we have? Why, United States, if you want to avoid Geneva, and we can understand why you might, why don't you use some of the pressure and some of the promise with which you're approaching us against the Egyptians and for the Egyptians? Offer them not investment without consequence, technicians to open the canal without some give on their part, but offer them economic opportunities, money, if you will, provided they are willing to do for us what you ask us to be willing to do for them. Don't make your pressure one-sided. If you're even-handed with your foreign aid, be even-handed with your political pressures. And that, of course, the United States has not been willing to do. We're moving towards Geneva. Egypt has begun the political infighting, trying to better the relations between Hussein and the PLO, sending her foreign minister this week to Moscow, encouraging contacts with Eastern Bloc nations and the NATO nations. Israel can trust only in her own will and her own willingness to sacrifice, and such power as she has, under terrific pressure. The United States has shut off further shipment of new arms to Israel. The so-called reassessment is taking place. Pressures must be tremendous between the United States and Jerusalem. And of course, with every pressure, there's a promise. Give up the land and we will guarantee you oil. Give up the land and we will guarantee you weapons. Give up the land and we will guarantee you foreign aid. I hope if Israel gives in that the American guarantees are better and sturdier than they have proven to be in some parts of the world. But I really hope that Israel will not give in, and that though it will set up some temporary tensions between Israel and the United States, it will lead to a reassessment of American attitudes and policies, which may cause the United States to see that even-handedness means not the cultivation of one side and pressures on the other, but pressures equally on both, as well as the cultivation equally of both. I doubt that if the countries of the world came to Geneva, much that is good would be the consequence. Remember that the last time the nations of the world tried to get to Geneva, it took them 2.5 years just to decide what kind of table everyone would sit around. I don't know what kind of table would exist at Geneva. I do believe that Geneva is not the answer. And nothing that I've said this morning should indicate to you that America is the enemy. The enemy is the obstinacy and the hatred and the violence which now courses throughout the Arab world. The enemy is the callousness with which the Soviet Union and their allies have in a one-sided way poured their treasure and their weapons and their technicians into the Arab world. The enemy is the whole swing of the Arab world and of the third world towards an anti-white racism and the choosing of a few sacrificial victims on which to vent their spleen and their centuries-old hatred. America is not the enemy. Dr. Kissinger is not the devil. But he's a devilishly shrewd man. And at this point in time, what he seeks is to serve his master. And what his master wants is what is good for American business. Big business. And what is good for American business is not necessarily good for Israel. Tensions, I'm sure, will run throughout the summer. Israel, fortunately, is at this point well-armed and newly armed. If a war were to come, it would lead to bloodshed, but it would not lead to defeat. She must be prepared to accept the slings and arrows of an unhappy bureaucracy in the hope that America will come to grips in a more realistic way with the problems which she faces. And recognize that only in a strong Israel will ever guarantee some degree of security and stability to that part of the world. Someone asked me the other day, what do I think of the possibilities of peace in the Middle East? I'm not very sanguine about the fact there may not be more bloodshed. But I'm also confident that the Middle East is not Southeast Asia, because Israel is not the corrupt, feudal, venal junta which governed Phnom Penh and governed Saigon. A free country, a young democracy, full of devoted, dedicated people. There's no civil war in Israel. There's an enemy, and there's the community. The community will do what is necessary, and hopefully the world will be moved to sympathy, to understanding, and to support. Amen.